Nowadays, when the Algonquin Round Table is mentioned, it is usually in connection with its most celebrated alumna, Dorothy Parker. But among the dozen or so regulars of that vicious circle of 1920s New York wits and literati, there was a man with Irish connections who is worthy of recall. Mark Connolly. Playwright, screenwriter, director, actor, journalist, and by the time of his death at the age of 90 in 1980, the last surviving member of that group. Connolly's versatility was on display early. At the age of 7, he established the Marcus Connolly Opera House in his parents' living room. There he had free rein as actor, author, director, and proprietor. He added to his repertoire with hypnotism demonstrations while at boarding school. A good student, he had aspirations to go to Harvard. But his father's death and the loss of the family business meant that the surviving Connollys were obliged to go to live with relations in Pittsburgh, where Mark got a job on a local newspaper. He started by collecting money owed for classified ads, but with skill and ambition, within a year he was a fully-fledged reporter. Among his duties was second-string theatre critic, which allowed him to feast on drama, comedy, and vaudeville. Before long, he was moonlighting as a dramatist for local groups. His first play, $2.50, played to poor attendances, as potential patrons mistook the title for an outrageously high ticket price. He was engaged to write book and lyrics for a comic opera, which eventually found its way to Broadway, with few of Mark's words still remaining, though he received full credit in the abysmal reviews. But he took the opportunity to move to New York and commenced a glittering career, culminating in the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1930 for his play The Green Pastures. This retelling of stories from the Old Testament, set in America's Deep South, featured Broadway's first all-black cast. Many years later, as a young boy, I was fortunate enough to be introduced to the great man. As he always did on such occasions, he solemnly shook my hand and advised, "Now, you can tell your friends you shook the hand of the man who shook the hand of Buffalo Bill." And it was true. When Mark was young, the Connollys ran a hotel in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. Among the notables who stayed there while performing in the town was that famous Indian scout turned self-promoting legend who toured his spectacular show, Buffalo Bill's Wild West, the length and breadth of the USA and Europe at the end of the 19th century. But this second-hand brush with greatness was not all Mark had to offer the young. Each year, he threw a lavish Thanksgiving Day party for the children of his friends, who were also invited. And as he and my father had gravitated together over a love of things Irish and literary, this included us. This party coincided with the famous Macy's Parade, whose star attractions, a series of giant inflatable replicas of cartoon stars, could be viewed not from below as usual, but at eye level through the windows of Mark's apartment on Central Park West. In addition, there were individual ice creams molded in the shape of a turkey, and gifts of the latest battery-powered toys imported from Japan, whose like we had never seen. Although his father, Patrick Joseph Connolly, was actually born in Pittsburgh and spelled his name with an O and an E instead of the two O's customary for Irish Connollys, Mark had an abiding love of Ireland. In his days as a literary lion, he was friendly with Yeats, Shaw, James Stephens, Oliver St. John Gogarty, and Lennox Robinson. He continued to visit Ireland well into his 80s, but in addition to the urban literary beau monde, he enjoyed the countryside too. Each time he landed at Shannon Airport, he hired a taxi to take him directly to wherever Duffy's Circus was playing that night. Arriving by water in Coote Hall, County Roscommon, he plucked a flower from the hedgerow and placed it behind his right ear. "To show the natives I am unmarried," he assured the startled parish priest. On another occasion, he joined us on a cruise across Lough Derg. As the afternoon wore on and Mark's impending transatlantic departure began to loom, my father threw caution to the winds and abandoned the marked navigation channels. This led to us hitting the rocks, not once, nor twice, but three times. When we finally deposited our precious cargo, shaken but not stirred, he thanked us, above all, for not breaking into Nearer My God to Thee. When Mark published his memoirs, Voices Off Stage, I received a copy inscribed For Jonathan, who shared so many of these adventures across the years. I was 10 years old at the time. But I took it as an acknowledgement that I had lapped up repeated tellings of these tales, some taller than others, and perhaps an inkling that I would continue to share them across many more years.
The subtitle is Observing Life. The main title is Lavery and Osborne. And it's the book rather than the catalogue that accompanies the quietly fascinating exhibition at the Hunt Museum in Limerick of some of the work of the largely contemporaneous Irish painters John Lavery and Walter Osborne. The exhibition, curated by Naomi O'Nolan and running until the end of September, has an innate fascination in that it shows a large number of works which haven't been seen in public before and have been painstakingly gathered from private collections both in these islands and the United States. But what is perhaps most interesting about the coupling of the two artists is the trigger it pulls. The work, which has often been categorised as of a kind, representative of an era that lies fallow between the Pre-Raphaelites and the Post-Impressionists, and holding its breath for the advent of modernism. Observe life, the two artists do, but the cover of the book shows their differences as much as their similarities. It shows details of Lavery's A Windy Day and Osborne's Seated Boy by the Sea. The first is the essence of leisured middle-class freedom, a woman walking on the beach at Tangier in 1905. The second, a gloomy figure of a boy who seems sunken himself, with only the sea behind him, lit by pale sunlight. Both are pictures that get under the skin, as work of real artistry always will. And yet both Lavery and Osborne, so often categorised together, sprang from the opposite of those depictions. John Lavery was born in Belfast, the son of an unsuccessful publican. Orphaned at the age of three, he was exported to relatives in Ayrshire and sent to work in a shop at an early age, then went on to work as a photographer's assistant in Glasgow, studying at night in the Haldane Academy. The young Osborne, son of a successful portrait painter, received a respectable gentleman's education in Dublin, and having won the Taylor Scholarship here at home, went on to study at the Academie Royale d'Anvers in Antwerp. Both settled briefly in separate artists' colonies in France, but in 1884, both settled back in Britain. The first painting of note by Lavery, the working-class Belfast boy, was The Tennis Party, a depiction of life at the prosperous MacBride family home outside Glasgow, which he showed at the Royal Academy in 1886. It, and Osborne's October by the Sea, showing, despite its revolutionary light, a scene of bleakness and inherent poverty on the Suffolk coast, brought both men into conflict with the fashionable formalism of the Academy of the day and led to them becoming part of the radical artist movement in the new English Art Club. Lavery was the first to receive a state accolade, a commission for a massive canvas showing more than 250 figures assembled for audience at the state visit by Queen Victoria to the Glasgow International in 1888. Perhaps overwhelmed at now being a society painter, Lavery took off for Tangier, which was to be a major focus for his work for many years and where he spent winters until the advent of Great War German U-boats made travel too dangerous. Looking at Tangier, the White City, painted in 1893 from a private collection and included in the Hunt exhibition, it's easy to see why. It looks across a great sweep of beach from above, with the Casbah on the far side of the bay. There's light, calm, and whiteness everywhere, showing a place with a soul open to the world for all its reputation for intrigue. After a few years finding subjects of rural idyll in England's home counties, Osborne settled back in Dublin, determined to concentrate on portraiture, and probably knowing that his assured place in Dublin society, or more accurately, Dublin Castle society, would ensure his success. But his work continued to show that much of his heart lay outside the drawing room, and his depictions of seedy lanes in inner Dublin and poverty-stricken holes in Limerick, as well as the harshness of Connemara life, continued to obsess him. Such works were a far cry from the subjects we immediately associate with him, the portraits of children mischievously engaged or solemnly attentive, heartwarmingly appealing, but always avoiding sentimentality. Unlike Lavery, Walter Osborne would not live to see the devastation of World War. He died in 1903, while John Lavery would live and work on for almost 40 years, not merely living through both World Wars, but working as an official war artist in World War I. He also played his part in the setting up of the independent Irish state, with his portrait of his second wife Hazel as Kathleen Ni Houlihan, gracing the new Irish banknotes. The eternal question remains on this and his many other portraits of his wife, several of them in the exhibition. Is it possible for any woman to have been so beautiful? And there's another home connection in the last dated canvas in the exhibition, Stars in Sunlight, from 1936, painted during Lavery's short, unsuccessful Hollywood trip. It shows Loretta Young and Maureen O'Sullivan lounging at a party in California sunlight. O'Sullivan, the girl from Dorky, who was Tarzan's first filmmate Jane and would become mother to Mia Farrow.
The luminous purple loosestrife and the sweet blackberries that grow along the ditches of Connemara's narrow roads and boreens in middle to late August delight the hearts of many. But for much of my working life, they've been responsible for a slight lowering of the spirits. Their annual appearance, although undeniably beautiful, coincided with the imminent end of the summer holidays and my return to the classroom in September. And so I came to associate them with an end to freedom, the concocting of schemes of work, and the preparation of class lists. But not this year. After nearly 40 years teaching, I've just retired. And like many newly retired people, I'm experiencing the unnerving process of metamorphosing from one state of being into an altogether unfamiliar state of being. Lines from Philadelphia, Here I Come spring to mind. On his last evening in Donegal, before he leaves for the US, Gar and his alter ego declare with a mixture of enthusiasm and wariness that all newly retired people recognise it's all over. And it's all about to begin. So what are you looking forward to most about being retired? My 6 years asked me back in May. I wanted to say that I was looking forward to seeing purple loosestrife and blackberries without a sense of foreboding. But I thought that would take too long to explain properly. And I was afraid they might misunderstand me and think that old age had withered me into cynicism. I'm not sure, I replied. The freedom, I suppose. And what are you going to miss about teaching? Oh gosh, I don't know. I wasn't trying to be evasive, but it seemed to me that an adequate treatment of two such major questions required at least a double period and a large cup of coffee. Whereas I knew I had only about 20 minutes left in which I needed to discuss both animal imagery and the theme of appearance versus reality in Macbeth. I struggled to come up with something. Remembering Gerard Manley Hopkins's comment about how he felt the tedium of marking exams was the student's revenge, I said simply, I know I'm not going to miss all the correcting and marking. On reflection, even that anodyne response seemed slightly cynical, and I was disappointed in myself. I've always resisted cynicism about teaching and resented it in others. The claim, brayed by the dinner party boor, that the three main reasons for becoming a teacher were June, July and August, always sounded like a cheap shot, while the supposedly witty line about education being the process of casting false pearls before real swine seemed to me a display of contempt for both learning and young people. Thinking about it now, I realise that one of the things I'll miss is the company of those young people. They have a way of keeping you grounded. One of the uncomfortable truths of the teacher's life is that each school year, you return to the classroom 1 year older, but the pupils seated in front of you are always the same age. As your teaching career progresses and you move irrevocably through your 40s and 50s towards your 60s, your first year pupils are permanently stuck at the second of Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man. There they are, every year, with their satchels and shining morning faces and that boundless energy, while you, now with fair round belly and spectacles on nose, can only contemplate a future sans teeth, sans eyes, and make a note to check your health insurance. Sisyphus would have had no problem understanding what it's like being a teacher with 30 or 40 years experience. As the age gap widens between you and your pupils, and Yeats's view that an aged man is but a paltry thing takes on an uncomfortable immediacy for you, it's healthy to be reminded that 30 of the 31 people in the classroom don't care much about Yeats's or your angst about human frailty. Their concerns are more immediate. How can I avoid detention for not having my French homework? How can I skip to the top of the lunch queue? What's happening in Game of Thrones? And that's as it should be. As the years slipped by, the more I felt that while being able to introduce pupils to The Great Gatsby or the poetry of Seamus Heaney was an enormous pleasure, the real privilege lay in being able to simply witness young people being young. And as my years slipped away, more and more, I envied them all the time they had ahead of them. Reading A Christmas Carol with a group of first years at the end of the autumn term was always an enjoyable experience. Scrooge's salvation in the closing pages and the assurance that Tiny Tim was not going to die were guaranteed to bring a lump to everyone's throat and maybe even a tear to the eye. But perhaps the most enjoyable reading of the novel I ever had was with a class where just as we reached the final words, God bless us, everyone, a pupil in the back row slammed the book shut, pushed it away from him in disgust, and complained loudly, "That book's a complete rip-off. What a scam." How do you mean, Ross? I inquired. "Well, it's obvious, isn't it? Your man Dickens just copied the entire plot from The Muppets' Christmas Carol. What a rip-off." Several heads were nodding in sympathy with Ross in the face of what was obviously a shameless act of plagiarism. I suppose I should have cleared up the misunderstanding straight away, but I'd enjoyed it too much. And I thought to myself, he's 12. He has plenty of time ahead of him to straighten things out. So I'd said something like, "Well spotted, Ross. We'll talk about that tomorrow."
When I was a child, I spent my summer holidays in Tralee with my aunt. In the mornings after 10 o'clock mass, she and her friends sat around the kitchen table, drinking innumerable cups of tea. The Rose of Tralee festival was much discussed. The tragic story that's claimed to be behind the ballad enchanted me. Imagine William Pembroke Mulchenock, heir to the big house and a poet too, falling in love with Mary O'Connor, a servant girl, like Cinderella, and writing for her. She was lovely and fair as the rose of the summer. Yet 'twas not her beauty alone that won me. Oh no, 'twas the truth in her eyes ever dawning that made me love Mary, the Rose of Tralee. And imagine further, Mary was the inspiration for the festival. The festival grew in popularity. I grew up, married, had children, and started to write historical fiction. A few years ago, the story lurking at the back of my mind became insistent. Records were sketchy, hard facts were few, but the legends had grown. I began to weave a story around the time of the Great Irish Famine, when Daniel O'Connell rallied for repeal of the Union and the White Boys were on the rise. What is known is that Mary lived in Brogue Lane, the heart of the shoemaking industry. Her father was a shoemaker with a good reputation, but little business acumen and known to be a bit too fond of a sup. It is also on record that the Mulchinocks lived in style at West Villa in the townland of Anna, farming, running a profitable dairy and having other commercial interests too. With those facts, I began to breathe creative life into Mary and William, fictionalising their first impressions of each other. He'd noticed her at the dance platform at Clahan. Dark-haired and pale-skinned, I wrote. She had danced with an inner joy he'd never forgotten. She'd seen him in town, a young man with a head of golden curls, his green greatcoat swinging open and his linen shirt sparkling white against his throat. Working as a servant at West Villa had to have been an eye-opener for Mary. The differences between the poverty of the lane and the luxury of the big house. The thought must have grown and lingered that she could better herself. I had her recoil from an arranged marriage and gave her ambition to be a teacher. Given the social mores of the time, any love affair between a gentleman and a servant girl would be likely to be a doomed one. But the die was cast on the morning William, back from visiting the west of Ireland, walked into the nursery where Mary was caring for his nieces. He became a regular visitor to the nursery, watching as Mary taught her charges, falling in love with her, and writing for her the ballad's opening verses. Mary too was smitten, but I felt she would have known her thoughts about him must remain a secret locked deep in her heart. Over time and happy outings that I enjoyed researching and writing, they acknowledged their love for each other and planned a life together. William was involved in politics, and on the instruction of Daniel O'Connell, he organised a repeal rally in Tralee. It is known that after the rally, a man was killed. William was accused and a reward offered for his capture. He left Tralee for France. West Villa was in an uproar, and when Mrs. Mulchinock realised her son's commitment to Mary, she dismissed her with, "Never again will you darken the door. Never will you have a future with the master." Through a series of interventions, William ended up in India, writing for the Bombay Times and gaining quite a reputation as a chronicler of the British Army in India. As the Great Famine devastated Ireland, Mary kept the family together, collecting the monies owed to her father, caring for her younger sisters and brother, nursing her mother until her death from consumption. Months bled into years until finally William was exonerated. As he arrived back in Tralee to make Mary his bride, it is documented that a funeral procession wound along Castle Street. "Who is it?" I had him ask. There was an edge to his awareness, a feeling that something was leaving an imprint on the atmosphere. It was Mary, dead from consumption, designated to a pauper's burial until he intervened. Had her buried at Clohebrine, no happy ending for that Cinderella, and each day he spent hours by her graveside. Around 1847, William married Alicia Keogh from Ballinasloe. Their names had been previously linked. They emigrated to New York, where he became a successful newspaper man. His ballads were published to acclaim. He counted poets Emerson and Longfellow as patrons. But he couldn't forget Mary. 5 years later, he left his wife and daughters and returned to Tralee. He took rooms in the town and founded the Kerry Star. The newspaper floundered. His health failed. He became depressed and drank heavily. He died in 1865 and at his request was buried alongside Mary.
I loved to stare into the glass cabinet in the good room. It had claw feet and a rich yellow satin backing. The perfect backdrop for my mother's best china. Some cups were gold-rimmed, so my eight-year-old self assumed they were 24-karat gold. Others depicted hunting scenes. Red-coated men on horses, leaping across hedges, with hounds trailing behind. I waited for the china to appear on the table, but it never did. Christmas Day, perhaps? No. Relations coming from England? No. My father's friend arrived from America, clad in a camel coat and shiny shoes and smelling like a movie star. Surely the good china would be taken out now. But no, the double glass doors remained stubbornly shut. Frustrated, I asked my mother why we were not using the china, and she said, "We're saving it for when the Queen comes to tea." I was beyond excited. The reverence given to the china cabinet finally made sense. I could picture Queen Elizabeth taking a dainty sip from the gold-rimmed cup, her footman standing to attention beside her. Now, the likelihood of the Queen coming to tea was remote, to say the least. We lived on a small farm in County Sligo, less than an hour from the border. It was the late 1970s. The Troubles were raging. I'm sure a visit to the Republic of Ireland was not high on Queen Elizabeth's list at that point. It wasn't even at the bottom of her list. But I was oblivious to all that and contented myself with imagined scenes of the royal family in our modest kitchen. There might be spam and a tin of potato salad if we were lucky. There would definitely be a Victoria sponge. You see, I knew all about the Windsors because of the magazines rolled up in a cylindrical tube that the postman brought every few months. Our relations in Cambridge would send home magazines such as Woman and Woman's Own, as well as the Beano and Bunty and Judy. When I had pored over the comics, I would leaf through the magazines, lapping up the photographs of the royal family and following the tribulations of the bachelor Prince Charles as the British nation willed him to find a bride. Our relationship with Britain back then, like now, was complicated. Almost every family had relations in Britain, and their visits home were the highlight of the summer. My siblings and I were very envious of the classmates who knew all about Blue Peter because they had access to the British television channels. We didn't, so to entertain ourselves, we read aloud the scrawling News for the Deaf, pretending we were the successors to Don Corburn and Charles Mitchell. We often took trips across the border to County Fermanagh to buy cheap tyres and marvel at the affordable price of chocolate. But I always felt uneasy approaching the checkpoints and being peered at by armed soldiers with strange accents. On every trip, my father would unfailingly point to the good roads and neat farmyards in the north and declare that we should hand the Republic of Ireland back to Britain and apologise for the mess we made of the whole thing. His was not a popular view in our locality. In 1979, young though I was aware that absolutely no one I knew would welcome the news that the Queen, Commander-in-Chief of the British Armed Forces, was coming to our house for tea. But the prospect delighted me, and I whiled away many pleasant hours gazing into the china cabinet and imagining the various scenarios that might unfold during the visit. The last Monday in August was a sunny day, and we were making a last-ditch effort to save the hay when my mother came running out into the field with the news. Lord Louis Mountbatten and three others had been killed in Mullaghmore after the IRA had planted a bomb on his boat. I still remember my parents' shock watching the news and my father's anger that people could do such a thing in our county. The troubles had come right to our doorstep. Only slowly did it dawn on me that the Queen was never coming for tea. But Queen Elizabeth did finally make it to Ireland in that moving and unforgettable visit of 2011 when she spoke Irish in Dublin Castle. And Prince Charles visited Mullaghmore 4 years later, something that would have been unthinkable a few short years before. I wonder what my mother would have made of it all. The thief of time had begun stealing her memories long before the Queen came to Ireland. Highlights from the royal visit were being replayed on television when I called to the nursing home a while ago. Well, she finally got to Ireland, but she never called for tea, I said. An uncertain smile played around my mother's lips. My sister is a proud custodian of the china now, but it has yet to make its debut on the kitchen table. I believe she's saving it for a very special occasion.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Man Who Shook the Hand of Buffalo Bill by Jonathan White, The Men Who Captured Irish Soul in Paint, Walter Osborne and John Lavery by Emer O'Kelly, A Matter of Time by Conall Hamill, Writing The First Rose of Tralee by Patricia O'Reilly, and The Queen and the Good China by Alison Healy. The music was The Algonquin Bounce by Mark Isham, Beausois by Claude Debussy, played on violin by Kyung Hwa Chung with Philip Moll on piano. We have All the Time in the World by Louis Armstrong and The Rose of Tralee sung by Kenneth McKellar.